Hello and welcome. I'm Renee Kemp in for Rose Aguilar today, and this is Your Call. Today we're celebrating National Poetry Month by hearing from two young poets and a senior program manager for Youth Speaks. Youth Speaks is a San Francisco-based organization that teaches young poets how to use their words to express themselves, to shape their world, and hopefully to build community. That program gives young people opportunities beyond where they happen to be so that they can discover and develop their own voices. And for 22 years, Youth Speaks has been doing just that. And we'll also be discussing this weekend's Youth Speaks Grand Slam. Two of the poets who are here today are going to be participating in that. It takes place Saturday the 14th at 7 o'clock in North Auditorium. The object is, of course, for these young people to share their thoughts about some of the most important issues of our time. So, joining us today is Dima Awadalla. She's in the eighth grade, and she's 13 years old. And this is her very first Youth Speaks Grand Slam. But she said she's been doing spoken word since the fifth grade. So, she's something of a veteran of this type of thing. She got involved with a program called Spark Poetry, and the rest, I guess, is history. So welcome, Dima.
Thank you.
Also joining us is Anvi Gulrajani. She's a junior in high school, and she's 16. This is her first slam poetry event with Youth Speaks, and her first time performing, as a matter of fact, in any type of slam poetry event. So Anvi, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And we also have Janae Johnson. She's been working for Youth Speaks for about 3 years, and she's been doing her own spoken word for about 7 years. So, Janae Johnson, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
You know, it occurs to me that poetry is such a raw thing. You know, you can't hide behind the words like you can in prose. Poetry is just stripped down and raw. And to me, a little scary. I imagine to a lot of people, poetry is just too much. It gives me chills just kind of thinking about the fact that you have to really put yourself out there. So let's start with you, Dima. How is it possible that you, especially at such a young age, feel compelled to just kind of put it all out there like that?
Well, I don't know. Like, if you think about it, youth doesn't really never really had much to say in like the world's problems, but through poetry you could just like anyone of any age just write anything and just tell their story. So I saw that as kind of like an opportunity, I guess.
Why poetry though? Why not I don't know, a novel or a short story? Why not one of those forms that aren't quite so stripped down?
I don't know. I feel like not really you can be taken more seriously with poetry. It's just, for me, it's more of a like wider variety, and there, like, from what I've experienced in these 4 years, there are a lot of people out there who are like in, especially like specifically in poetry, who are willing to listen to all the stories that we have to tell, and it's kind of like a more community thing. So I guess that's why I joined poetry rather than like something else.
So you were looking to reach beyond yourself to other, maybe other
right.
poets even.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. And Anvi, once again, I mean, you know, guys are so young. And I imagine the first time you produced a poem, was it sort of roses are red, violets are blue, or was it really deep and kind of scared your parents when they saw it? Like, oh my gosh, where is this coming from?
Yeah, I think it was not the roses are red kind of a thing. Most of my poetry came from anger and confusion over my community being different from what I was used to. I was kind of thrown into something where I was like the token diverse character, which was confusing for me. So my poetry came from there, and my parents were very confused at the first time they heard my poetry, and they'd never heard of slam being immigrants. Even a lot of my poetry goes over their heads, but they've been pretty supportive about it.
Talk about how your culture is expressed through your poetry and the anger that your parents saw through these words. Perhaps they wouldn't have known how you were feeling if it weren't for this art form. So just talk about that a bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Most of my poetry is about my culture, my race, and how I'm perceived in society, because usually there aren't really platforms where South Asian immigrants get to talk about that. It's kind of like growing up without seeing your picture on the wall. And writing poetry helped me express that to my parents, that I did feel different, even though like this home community might be a safe place. As soon as I step out of it, I am different. And it helped them understand, because they might not comprehend that difference in their daily lives. Like, they think it's normal to go through microaggressions on a daily basis, but I was looking around me and seeing that not everyone was going through this. So that helped bridge, poetry did help bridge the gap between us.
Do you even remember your first poem?
My first poem, slam poem. I didn't know they were called slam poem. I thought I was writing slam poems. I thought I was writing songs.
Interesting.
At the time, yeah, it was about, actually, that was also about my culture. It was about my community and how there's certain expectations once you're like an immigrant to the U.S. to become something big, because your parents have made such a big sacrifice, and there's a lot of pressure that you have to take certain jobs and become an engineer or a doctor or be some sort of like successful, take some sort of successful job that, where you participate in like capitalistic society. That was kind of what it was about, but mm-hmm. very dumbed down version of that.
But you're just so young. It occurs to me, I look at these fresh little young faces, and I have a hunch when we begin to hear some of your work, we'll wonder, wow, that still waters run pretty deep. But let's talk a bit about the competitive nature of poetry. Janae Johnson, you've been preparing these young poets to become not just poets, but performers. So talk about the slam culture and how it gets them out of themselves and their poetry and makes them into performers.
Right. So Poetry Slam has been around for about 30 years, and it is kind of a trick to get folks to interact with the poets on stage. So it's a little bit different than an open mic. It's scored on a scale of 0 to 10 from some judges, but more often than not, it's a community builder. And everybody who's in the room of a Poetry Slam is feeling the Poetry Slam. And so this particular competition, the Teen Poetry Slam, it's kind of Olympic style. So it's a preliminary rounds and semifinal rounds, and now the finals, which is this Saturday. And the ways in which we've prepared the performers is we've had some workshops that are offered to the finals performers, and we have workshops throughout the entire year, but specifically to help them feel comfortable on stage and encourage them to move however they feel like they need to move, project however they feel like they need to project, and more so feel comfortable on a big stage like the Norse Theater, which could be intimidating. But for me, I like stages because I don't get to see people in their eyes. I like to just like look into the darkness and just do my poem. And so I think this is a good opportunity for folks to actually see some of the poets that competed this year.
It seems to me that poetry is such an inward journey that it almost seems antithetical to be asked in a situation like the Poetry Slams to actually project and put it out there in the world, almost like you have turned yourself inside out. So how many poets do you find are introverts who are actually being pushed out into the world, and how many were just extroverts waiting to happen and this poem was the vehicle?
I would say it's about 50-50, and I would actually consider myself to be an introvert in that way. And so I think that writing things down is really, really cool. But then when you speak it out loud to a person, you're like, oh, wow, I actually said that. Okay, these are my words. Wow, this is amazing. And then when you start speaking it again, I think that there's a journey that goes on with the stories that you tell and how folks feel around like their own words and their connection to their own words. And so we don't necessarily tell people to, this is how you project. We could give you tips, but it is how folks feel like telling their stories and what is genuine and authentic to them, and we promote that.
And Janae, how important have you thought it was as you were preparing them to kind of give them an idea of where they are in this whole continuum that goes back thousands of years, whether it was the Bible and Songs of Solomon or Homer and the Iliad and Allen Ginsberg's Howl movement? I mean, do you take them there or do you not think that's really important?
I think that we don't stress that the specific histories of Poetry Slam as much, because some of them could be not as helpful for the folks there today. I think that what we try to do is talk about they're part of a specific movement in a specific community, not just in the Bay Area, but all around the world. And kind of, I feel like one of you all spoke to this a little bit earlier in terms of like, this is a community builder. This is how, this is the space in which we get to meet people and call them family.
And this is kind of the Super Bowl coming up, so let's just kind of discuss how the Grand Slam works. It's like the grand finale of a month-long competition, and young artists perform their latest work in front of an audience and a panel of judges, and the top six poets at the Grand Slam then go on to represent the Bay Area at the 22nd annual Brave New Voices event, and that's in Houston in July. But it's also a place for these young folks to be seen and heard by their community. So Dima and Anvi, you're both finalists competing in the Grand Slam this Saturday. Tell us a little bit about how you prepared. So we can start with you, Dima. How did you get ready for this?
Well, for starters, there was the workshop that we talked about, like on Saturday and Wednesday, and they gave us some really good advice. They were taught us about like performance and how to project, and we actually performed in front of them. And they gave edits, the really, really helpful edits. So that was one way we prepared. And then I guess it was just memorize. Like, for me personally, a lot of things that I heard from people were just memorize your poem, like, get ready, because they made it sound like such a big event. And I'm pretty sure it is. There's thousands of people there. But, yeah, there was a lot to do.
And this is a big deal. Something like 200,000 young people around the country every year participate. More than 500 youth poets hailing from the Bay Area are part of this. So I'm wondering, Anvi, how you were able to select the works that you decided to perform. Was it like choosing between your favorite pets or friends?
Even more intense, I feel like maybe choosing between your children, which one's your favorite, because they're all like parts of you and individual things you want to say, and you kind of want to treat each as best as you can. For me, it was like choosing, because I'm on a platform for the first time in front of this many people, so it was like, what do I want to say that can reach all of these people? What can I say that they can relate to, and what kind of a message do I want to send to them? What will they be able to understand, and will they be able to see my perspective? So the poems I chose were coming from there.
If you're just joining us, I'm Renee Kemp, and this is Your Call. Anvi Gulrajani and Dima Awadalla are two young poets who are going to be participating in the Youth Speaks Grand Slam this weekend. And Janae Johnson is sort of their coach and mentor in this process. And you too, Janae, are a poet. And I wonder how you... I've often wondered, how do you compare poems? How do you compare things that are so specific and personal and judge these things? How does that happen?
Poetry Slam is very silly in that way, because it is judged on a scale of 0 to 10. I think the ways in which when I've judged off of my interpretation of writing and performance. And so that's what we tell our in content, and that's what we tell our judges to judge based off of. We don't necessarily sway them in any particular way, but it's their interpretation of it. I think for me, it's did you tell the most urgent, not the most urgent story, but the story that you chose, was that conveyed in the best way that you could possibly convey it? And I think that's specific for every single individual, and that's not of you're a better quote-unquote writer or you're a better quote-unquote performer, but this story moved me or this poem moved me in a way in which I think you just told your truth on stage, and that's kind of how I gauge it. But I think every single judge gauges it on a different scale, and it could get ridiculous sometimes, but oftentimes at the end of the day, people are glad that they shared their stories on a stage.
Are the judges swayed by the amount of applause or the audience reaction, or are these judges people who are just strictly judging on content?
I think that in a in a lot of poetry slams, sometimes scores are put up so everybody could see them. Mm-hmm. And usually people boo the judges or people sway the judges in different ways. Mm-hmm. You Speaks has moved into what we call silent scoring. And so they don't necessarily, nobody sees the scores until the end. And so I think that is a way to, one, move the show quicker, but then also de-emphasize the scores. It's like, we really just want to hear your truth on the stage. And we don't necessarily, the scores, they're great and all, and they help us learn who advances. But at the end of the day, we really want folks to focus on the young people.
You know, the spoken word is such a powerful thing, and certainly in the history of the African and African-American culture, it's the way that some of the African culture managed to survive the Middle Passage. And I'm just wondering about how spoken word has shaped your life and been able to help you express your particular culture. Dima?
Well, like, in fifth grade, I went from writing poems about, like, the zoo or hippos and monkeys and stuff, and then I learned about spoken word, and I realized that there are a lot of problems out there that these young people, like, have something to say about them. And then I wrote a team piece with a couple of members from Spark, and, like, it was about gun control, and I realized that, you know, like, there are problems out there that we want to say, and so spoken word has really, like, moved me, you know.
And for you, Anvi, I'm wondering how maybe poetry has shaped your life outside of poetry.
Yeah, absolutely. So poetry has, if someone were to ask me when I found my quote-unquote voice, I would say when I started performing my poetry for the first time, that's kind of when I found my voice, because I didn't think I could say these things out loud, because usually people would feel a little uncomfortable. But once you're on that stage and you have a community of people willing to listen to you and willing to cheer you on and tell you, I feel you, I understand what you're saying, and I am going to take that with me outside of this room, that really helped me grow and helped me with my poetry and with my life outside, because I realized that if this community is willing to listen to me, maybe I should speak up more outside of it. Mm-hmm. And although there may be dissent, there are some people out there willing to listen, even outside the poetry community.
Same question for you, Dima. How has being a poet impacted the other parts of your life?
It definitely helped me, like, speak out with skills. Like, so now I know what to say when I'm talking to someone, if we're talking about a big problem. Like, if we're doing seminars at school, I have a better experience with speaking because of poetry. And like she said, how she found her voice, I'm still trying to find my voice. Like, I don't know what I feel comfortable with writing about yet, but I know that whatever I'm going to write about, it's going to be good, and it's going to come from here. Mm-hmm. And, like, it's going to be, like, more like myself, and that's what I'm trying to find right now. So
what have you decided to share with us today, poetry-wise?
There's a poem I wrote. It's called Music, and it was actually my first poem that I wrote that was, like, my breakthrough when I realized this is spoken word, and you can write about problems, and you can express them to the world. Mm-hmm. So
this is Dima Awadala.
Well, I'm going to need a minute to get it up.
Sure.
Let me tell you about music. Let me tell you about this worldwide language that flows in the crust of the earth and in skin-colored hands and calloused fingertips. Definition: vocal or instrumental sounds combined to produce form, harmony, and expression of emotion. When Bartolomeo Cristofori invented the piano, he stood back and admired his work, looked down at worn white hands and connected them 6,000 miles down in Africa, where captive palms beat drums one last final time before they were torn away from their music to beat holes in soil that they can't understand down in the music room. I learned to use ivory and elephant tusks to play a song, could create notes that ricochet off the soundboard and ring in everyone's ears, ring back memories of 1768. The first performance of a piano, the first words of a language spoken where white keys correspond with black ones. The piano was invented centuries ago, home to hundreds of symphonies. So what changed in the past 200 years? Why do I hear bias whenever I play a note? Why do I feel the sound of Stephen Clark's wounds echoing through the halls with every key? My fingers hover over B4 and E5. My mind turns back to 17th century America, where white landowners towered over black families in the social structure, but little do they realize that the scale always leads back to do. So what are we really listening to? Harmony, when two or more notes played at the same time sound good together, when a black woman can date a white man without receiving looks, when I am no longer seen as a threat from the Middle East, my fingertips pressed on the keys so hard like I never want them to come up, I am angry for the landowners who played vicious songs against innocent backs, for my parents having to go through twice as many security checks because of our destination, for every color drained since the making of the harpsichord, the Celestia, the no wonder the black keys are always smaller than the white ones, the Civil War begins. As 620,000 men kill each other and die for a reason none of us could accept, maybe we could all just play a song or something to remind us of the things that two colors could create together. I know why Cristofori invented this. He knew that before humans go extinct from war, there has to be some kind of reminder of life before that. So we created this power, put it in the back frame and the dampers and the soundboard, called it music, because whether it's classical or jazz or hip-hop is all still music, and it rests in all colored minds alike like an icebreaker at a date. It's the glue between random people in the streets, like kids holding hands when crossing the streets. When I close my eyes, I see the next generation collecting on piano keys like dust. I mean, look at us. This is not your music anymore. This isn't your music. This is our language. Listen, it's getting louder.
Well, okay. I've got a little bit of whiplash here. We went, wow. Amazing.
Thank you.
Amazing. They're applauding in the control booth, like, wow. Okay. Where did this come from? Why was music the pin where you started and went from? Why music?
That's actually a funny story. This was like the first poem. I don't know where it came from, but we were sitting at practice one day, and my coach from Spark, he said, all right, everyone stop what you're doing. I want you to write a poem about music. And I don't know where it came from. I just wrote about this, and I realized that each person in this room writing about something has a problem to talk about. And like I've seen a couple of their poems, so mostly what I've learned about spoken word, not like talking about performance and poetry-wise, but the subjects, is from watching other people at the little school slams we held and like what kind of poems they wrote. And pretty much I just like took some ideas and I thought about, okay, how does this relate to me? So I kind of just put that in this poem because at that point I was tired of like writing weird rhyme poems that never made sense to me. So today I just like said like, I'm going to take this poem, I'm going to put this subject in it. And then I never thought that it would like blow up to become one of my classics.
And talk about the creative process. I mean, did it fall down on the page just like that?
No. This came from sixth grade. It's been like a couple of years. So this took a lot of editing over the years. I had a lot of help from my team and from our teachers. Honestly, like I wouldn't have been able to write this poem without learning from anyone else, from like learning from my team and learning from them. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I perform this poem quite a lot. I've had a lot of edits from it online and stuff. So, yeah, it's come a long way, I think.
Well, you certainly took us on a journey. And is that the intent? Is that the idea?
Yes, like trying to add imagery into this subject of the piano and how, like, the black keys correspond with the white ones and how I think that that's a really good lesson for the world, like, you know.
And the black keys are always smaller, and why do we get stopped at security? I mean, when I first started listening, I kind of had my eyes closed, like, yeah, I'm with you. And then all of a sudden, as you were taking us
yep.
to the reel, it was like, okay, it's all right.
Turn.
It's remarkable.
Thank you.
Remarkable.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Are you going to do that one at the slam?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, you should.
Thank you.
That's good. We're going to come back with Anvi Gularajani and her poem right after this. Stay with us. For those of you just joining us now, I'm Renee Kemp in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. We are podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org, and you can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. And we love it when you have a show idea. Drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org. You can also give us a call at 866-798-8255. Tomorrow on the weekly Friday Media Roundtable, we're going to cover the Facebook testimony this week by CEO Mark Zuckerberg, data collection and regulation, what's next. Also, Sinclair Media taking over local news and new developments in Trump world. So join us tomorrow. Today, we are talking with young poets from the Bay Area spoken word program Youth Speaks, Dima Awadalla and Anvi Julrajani. They are young poets at Youth Speaks and the senior program manager at Youth Speaks, Janae Johnson. They're preparing for this weekend's Youth Speaks Grand Slam that takes place on Saturday the 14th at 7 o'clock in Norse Auditorium. And we heard from Dima Awadalla before we went to break. And now we're going to hear from Anvi Gulrajani. So what have you decided to share with us, Anvi?
Coincidentally, it's also my first poem. My first slam poem and the first one I ever performed. Excuse me, sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you always pick a fight with everyone you meet? Why does it seem like you are never ready to accept defeat? Why do you insist that what is right is right? Don't you know? Not everything is black and white. Why can't you let things go? It makes me uncomfortable. After years of getting asked these questions, I ask them to myself. Why do I always insist on drawing a line, putting up a fight, speaking my mind, standing up for what I believe is right when it makes people uncomfortable? Let me tell you a story. I had a dream that one day I could peel off this brown hair, brown skin, brown eyes to reveal blonde hair, bright white skin, blue eyes, because what I was nothing more than a disguise I had not realized. Intersectionality is my identity. I am more than one minority, catcalled as mommy and sister. I am an in-betweener. I lie between the lines of what is black and white. I am defined by a small black line that lies between a dichotomy on a blank white page devoid of the history of my community. That hyphen between Indian and American defines me. I have been shamed for letting my garden go, for forgetting to weed and tear out the seeds that sow the reeds, allowing my fro to grow. So I have asked, why is it unclean for me to be seen complete and uncut? I have been shamed for allowing the collision of two countries on my tongue. With precision since I was young, I have watched my speech, trying not to preach, keep my culture covered under a cloak of Pakistans, Irans, and Afghanistans, Americanizing the other, the mother, my mother tongue. I have been shamed for what I ate because what I put on my plate didn't allow me to assimilate. I hated that my culture didn't fit between two slices of white bread, so I threw away my lunch each day instead, and I cried to myself, and I tried to eat mayo, and I tried to eat deep-fried food each day, but my tears tasted better. At least they had salt, the only spice from my culture with which you didn't find fault. I tried so hard to fit into your society, but you were so quick to stereotype me. If in 2003 we got the Statue of Liberty, we would have given it back because the French didn't help us in the war against Iraq, and even if we took it, we would have given it back because welcoming immigrants is no longer a requirement. Diversity? Save it for a pack of Skittles. But even then, we pick our favorite color. We like our country like we like our picket fences. Whitewashed. Despite all of this, I have some kind of hope, because if the Pope can say gay rights are A-okay, then maybe one day my shame will go away. I dream a society with unity where humanity rules. Don't get me wrong. I am under no delusion that the seclusion and segregation will just disappear. I know that that day is nowhere near, but I hope. And hope is an action, and in order for any reaction, I have to question. I have to speak my truth, no matter how uncomfortable it makes you. You see, America split society up into homogenized bubbles. Strip that down and whiteness will struggle. We never fix the racial disparity. We talk about equity and equality and white conventions full of pretension. Race is discussed with apprehension, and even the mention of a solution causes contention, because apparently whiteness is in comprehension, still busy understanding the problem in the first place. In order for me to help shift that conversation, I have to make you uncomfortable. I know you think my questions, my actions are an overreaction to a problem you consider fractional. But I have trouble letting things go.
And again.
Let's go.
Wow. Wow. Anvi Gulrajani. Well.
Yep.
So, let's talk about your performance and your work, and then we'll go back to Dima's that we heard just before the break. So are you trying to make people uncomfortable?
I think to some extent, yes. because I think it's important to do that, because unless you're put in a place where you're uncomfortable, you're in a conversation where you're not entirely sure what to say, you can never learn. So I think in order to teach people who may not have the same lived experiences as you, you have to express what it is, even if it does make them uncomfortable.
How do you know when you're getting through, when you've hit that that mark?
It's been hard to know when you're getting through, but I think a lot of times people come up to you and tell you that what you've said has touched them, or they've gone through a similar thing, or you hear people say, I don't get it, and then you're like, okay, I'm going to try again with a different poem, because I want you to be able to get it, but I'm not going to compromise my art just because there was some sort of dissent.
I wonder about that, Dima. I mean, does it matter if it goes over people's heads, or they can't relate, or they just don't get it? Does it really matter?
Well, I think it depends on the poet. Like, you could be targeting a specific group, or you could be targeting a specific person, and for a lot of people, it will just go right over their head, like you said. But if you're willing to tell them again and again and again until they understand, until, like, you feel satisfied with how many people know about what you want to say, then, yeah, go for it. But, like, I guess, I don't know. I'm not sure.
Can I interject?
Sure, absolutely.
Please. And sometimes sometimes the poem isn't necessarily for others. It's for you. So at times it's more therapeutic than trying to make people uncomfortable.
I wonder about that, whether this is in there and it's got to get out, and the rest of you just get on the other side of this thing. I can't help you if you don't get it. It just has to come out. I wondered about that. Well, let's invite, now that our listeners have heard some of your work, let's invite them to weigh in. How has poetry played a role perhaps in your life? Have you ever been to a poetry slam or participated in one? And how did you feel seeing and hearing those performances? And perhaps you're a young poet or writer or artist, and we'd like to know where you might have found some guidance and how you were able to bring forth your work to the community. Give us a call, 866-798-8255. And Janae Johnson, you are sort of a mentor, but also a fellow artist. And I do wonder if you ever feel the need to rein them in or pull them back or redirect. Just how much do you do in the way of what does your mentoring look like for them?
Yeah, so I mean, I coached the team last year, and some of the things that we asked them is, what do you really mean by that? And it's more so just a reflection on their part of making sure that what they're saying might be clear to them, or and might be clear to possibly the audience. I think it's clear to them first. I think that some people try to share a story and maybe they cannot convey what their story is about. So it's our job as coaches and as mentors to say, hey, what do you really mean, or why? And looking at what they come up with and saying, yeah, that might be the core of your piece. And so maybe we should just stick there and keep going with this. And so it's more so an experience in which we ask the poets of how they want to be guided.
And you sort of act, I imagine, as a crucible, where you kind of burn away the extra and get right down to the core of what it is they're trying to say, yes?
Yeah, yeah, because, I mean, poetry, slam poetry in general, or a poetry slam, is specifically has a time limit. And so it's 3 minutes and 30 seconds for Brave New Voices and Teen Poetry Slam. And so that means that some of the extra words or some of the extra things might not be able to fit within that time limit. And so our job is to say, okay, you have 3 minutes and 30 seconds. What do you have to say? And is what you have to say, is this urgent? Does it make sense? And can the audience get a full picture of what you're trying to speak about in this time limit?
And certainly I imagine that the internet has changed and how the impact of spoken word, how has it impacted it?
Oh, tremendously, tremendously. I think that when I was growing up, that was the era of deaf poetry jam on HBO, and that wasn't necessarily readily accessible. You had to have HBO and you had to have an interest in poetry. But I think now you could just go to YouTube, and all types of poetry is very readily accessible to folks. And so I think that people have different entry points because of that. And I think that it's great because whether you live in Idaho or Virginia or Florida, you have almost the same resources online as anybody has. And so I think that's a beautiful thing because it's not very specific to do you have cable? Mm-hmm. It's right. Like, cool, do you have access to a computer? Which is a lot easier now than it was back then.
Well, in listening to the two poems that we've heard so far, I think that the difference is pretty remarkable. And there was a cadence, there was a rhythm that was completely different in each one. I don't know, was there iambic pentameter like you learn in English class, or do you just let it flow? So I noticed that there was a certain cadence in yours, Anvi. So talk about how that happened. There was a bit of rhyming in there. Did that just happen, or did you make that happen?
Originally, I think it kind of just happened, especially with this poem. But then you kind of build that rhythm, and once you get into it, sometimes you hit like a kind of a little bit of a writer's block, and then you have to make it happen, but usually it kind of just flows. Yeah, I never understood iambic pentameter in class, still don't. Sorry. To every English teacher out there, yeah, but I just never connected with that kind of poetry. And actually, you're talking about the Deaf Poetry Jam. That was actually my introduction into slam poetry. I was on YouTube. It was in my recommended. I watched a video, and I was like, whoa, people do this? And so that kind of gateway into poetry really helped me.
I also wonder, too, Dima, about your desire and intent to shake people up, make them uncomfortable, and push them out of their comfort zones. I mean, is that deliberate, or is that just a byproduct of just doing what you do?
I kind of feel like when you go on that stage, the only person you're trying to impress is yourself. And the only person, like, other than, like, going out there and speaking out, you're just trying to, like, feel, like, if you feel comfortable with your poem, and you know that it speaks out to you, and you know that people will, like, someone in the crowd will see that, then I think you're good. Like, what was it? Your poem, you're trying to make people uncomfortable, right? So a way that, like, making up people, like, feel disturbed and, like, moved by your poem a lot is probably the intent of a lot of poems on stage. Like, you're trying to teach them, like, you're trying to go so hard on them so that they know this is a serious problem, like the serious issue that you want to talk about. So if you're just like telling them, hey, there's the racism out there, I'm going to talk about racism, that's cool for a lot of people. But if you really want people to, like, if you want to give them a call to action, some people like it's a good strategy to make people uncomfortable and tell them that, hey, I'm really serious about this, and that you should listen to it. So it's not really discipline, but, like, I don't know.
Is there a theme that you come back to again and again, that you find yourself starting to write about one thing and somehow it goes back to something again that has just really stuck with you and you have a need to discuss and get out there?
Yeah, I think that's a really good skill in poetry. Like, here, I the theme was music, and, like, I revolved around music, and then I talked about how music, like, sometimes it's like I talked about, like, how I connected it to racism, you know, you saw that, like, I bridged it to racism, and then I brought it back and I did a callback, and I, like, talked about keys and I implied metaphors. So that's one really good skill that people use when writing poems, is to, like, have callbacks. And when you start off with a theme in slam poetry, you should bring it back to your actual topic.
So there is there's a method here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because for those of us listening and enjoying it, it just feels like it's just a flow. But there's actually a method here that you're using to evoke what you're trying to evoke.
Right, right. And in the end, it's just this, like, masterpiece that you've created in that. Yeah, pretty much.
We're speaking with Dima Awadalla, Anvi Gulrajani, and, of course, their mentor, Janae Johnson, about the Youth Speaks program and the Youth Speaks Grand Slam that's coming up this weekend. If you're ready, Dima, we'd love to hear another poem. Are you ready with another?
If I could find one, yeah.
Sure. Take your time. In the meantime, if you happen to be a poet or enjoy poetry or see the value of poetry in the times in which we live as a means of expression, give us a call, 866-798-8255, if you'd like to talk with these young poets. Anvi, while she's checking, while Dima's looking, you have one ready?
Yes.
All right.
Back when tweezers were your best friend, my bushy eyebrows were an untrend. Back then, the only black swoosh you liked was the one on the side of your shoes. Nikita became Nikki, but you only like Nike. Now look at you. Eyebrows on fleek, right? So naturally, this raised a lot of questions for me. Why did pop stars get to wear henna to Coachella and I was asked why my skin looked like a Mandela, as in Nelson, not a mandala, because although my pronunciation was a topic for discussion, your blatant ignorance was just a sign of innocence. When did bindis become indie? Let's go down the path of history. Indus to Sindhu to Hindu to Indian. I guess I missed it. How come Queen Bee can take a part of my identity and Chris Martin, my bae, can put it on display and everything's okay just because it's Coldplay? 200 years ago, your ancestors came to my mother's country and killed every yogi, calling it paganism. Now, in a dimly lit LA studio, you preach spirituality next to a statue of Kali. You chant namaste while telling me to go away, praying for me to go back to my country. So I asked, why am I appropriated and not appreciated? Why is my culture up for grabs? My question was questioned. Why was it not okay for me to say, unless you are prepared to watch your people buried because they were shot at their place of prayer? No, you cannot have parts of my culture, because my faith comes with it. My skin comes with it. My body comes with it. Everybody wants to be exotic until the next terrorist attack, when standing in a 7-Eleven with a brethren in a turban in a suburban part of the country you call home makes you feel too exposed, too vulnerable to violence. Next time you wear a turban from Urban Outfitters, let me know if a TSA agent ignores your fundamental rights and puts their hands down your pants in front of hundreds of antsy travelers, asks you about the terrorist attacks in France, and proceeds to tell you that you were only selected by chance, because the entire system is random, right? Pretending to be black is only cool until the sirens are back, unless you are prepared to watch people stare at your culture like vultures trying to ingest whatever little is left. No, you cannot have a part of my culture. It's appropriation, not appreciation, but we don't have this conversation because my words make you uncomfortable. Guess what? You make me uncomfortable, so I will tell you, no, you do not have the right to artificially adjust the concentration of melanin in your skin till you become ethnically ambiguous. Culturally mysterious has led to persecution and violation of the Constitution, timely execution of people, despite our elocution that this inquisition needs an end. I am no rhetorician, but the definition of Indian is an Islam, and Islam is an ISIS, despite this. February 23rd, 2017, a man walked into a bar. I know this sounds like the beginning of a joke, but just listen. You see, this bloke chose to invoke his Second Amendment right that night. It ended in gun smoke, a man's body covered in oak and fire, burning at a pyre while his family spoke to the police. It had seemed that the man had walked into the bar in peace, and Trini's skin was too easy to mistake for terrorist, so he shot at the brownness. Tanning to the point where you become someone else, Rachel, isn't only pointless, it's offensive. You turn my identity into a trend, and the problem with every trend is that it will come to an end, and soon whiteness will replace brownness and your tan will fade. But mine won't. Soon, wearing a bindi to Coachella will be so last year, but I'll be standing here, bindi on, wondering where the hell I went wrong.
Mm. Hey. All
right. That was deep.
Uh-huh. Anvi Gulrajani. Well, what do you hope people walk away thinking after hearing this?
I know a lot of people don't really know about cultural appropriation, mm-hmm. So I hope there's kind of a little bit more of an understanding of that. And I know I think the conversation about cultural appropriation tends to be very shallow. It tends to be, oh, this is mine, don't take it from me. But there's a lot of impact of what cultural appropriation does, because it's more than just taking a part of someone's culture. It's really telling them that this is okay on me, but when it's on you, you're either a threat, or you're I know a lot of people have heard ghetto, or you're a ratchet, and that has more social implications than just those words, that can have systemic implications. And so just trying to connect basic cultural appropriation with those systemic impacts that it has for real people in real communities is kind of what the point was.
Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes you just have to stop for a second, because it kind of just, it really is very powerful, and it's so much to think about. And I wonder the difference between being able to see what you were saying in words, go back, read it over again, but the power of the immediacy, like if you didn't hear it, you missed it. How important is it that I can't go back and read what you just said? I had to stay in the moment and listen while you did it live and in real time.
I think that it's it can be both an advantage and a disadvantage, but I like to look at it as more of an advantage because if you can go back and read it, you're kind of browsing over it, you're going back, but the emotions aren't necessarily as intense. Like when I'm listening to someone else's poetry, whether it be Dima's or Janae's, I'm immediately feeling emotions and I'm snapping along with them. I'm going, mm-hmm, because I really am connecting with it, whereas I feel like when the poetry is on a page, you're not necessarily doing that.
Dima,
yes.
If you're ready, we'd love to hear from you.
All right. This poem's kind of like rough drafts, not very edited much. It's kind of short, too. I am a question mark. I always end the statement with a mystery. I always leave stuff behind for someone else to finish. Always supposed to be round and curvy. Always complaining. Always making things complicated. I am a cliff. I am unfinished and crumbly and threatening the ground with rock-hard comments below me, and I throw dirt at the cliffs down and I am falling. I am eroding under the weight of all these expectations. Ledges can only take so much pressure before we collapse on our sisters. But I am a question mark, and that is everything. And if the cliffs want to break down, let the gender roles blow away in the wind, leave the sedimentary to cluster and harden, write them down in stone and form new rock, to pebble, to stone, to strong, to an opportunity to answer our own questions.
Dima Awadala. Excellent. Just special. Excellent.
Thank you.
It's an in-the-moment kind of thing. I think that's what I love so much about spoken word. And I'll ask you the same thing I ask Anvi. What do you want people to walk away thinking or feeling after having heard that?
So this poem was like about gender roles and how most of the time in different countries too, in all worldwide, women are looked down upon and just treated like a question mark. Like I said, I tried to add a lot of figurative language in there, and I tried to like add some imagery. I talked about how if like people give us all these expectations and we're just listing all the things that women worldwide have to go through, and being catcalled and being like expected to do this or do that, I thought that if that's gonna happen again, we're all going to fall. And I thought about like how would we avoid this, what kind of solution could we think of? It like, that's how I always try to end my poems, with a positive note. That's what we learn in Spark, like to give them a call to action. So what can you do to help us like avoid this problem? And I thought, well, maybe if we like rose up, you know, that's kind of like a revolution, kind of what poetry to me is all about.
Well, poets, I think, are inherently political, and young people for time immemorial have been political. So it doesn't surprise me. And certainly with the movements that have come out of Parkland, Florida, we've seen young people rise up in ways that are just extraordinary. And you know, I guess what I'm wondering, especially after hearing your poet, though, poetry, Dima, you said this is a work in progress, right?
Yeah.
How do you know it's not done?
Because I know that I can do better. I know that I can write more. I know that I can add on to this. I know that I can convince more people to listen to this and, like, really know the poem, what I'm talking about. Like, if there's more to add, if you still have something on your mind, you write it down. Like, even if you're, like, thinking about it in your sleep, you just can't sleep because of it, you should wake up, get a notebook, and, like, write it down. And then you can always make something better, always.
And, Janae, just speak to the politics of poetry.
The politics of poetry, what do you mean by that?
The fact that poetry seems to me to be inherently political, that I think one of them mentioned that, you know, I started out thinking this was a song,
right.
But no, it turns out this was something much deeper, much different, and poetry over time has always seemed to address some of the most difficult things happening in any particular society at any particular time. So is it just a coincidence that poetry seems to speak to issues of the time?
Yeah, I think that the unique thing about poetry is that it does speak to the now. It does speak to like what is happening in your body and what's around the world. And I think poetry has shifted throughout the years because of the events that are going on around us, because of the people around us, because of the ways in which we're interacting with our friends, with our families, and whatnot. I think that the unique thing about poetry is, if you want to know the stories of our time right now, go to a poetry slam, and you will hear a wide range of topics, and you will hear things that are like that. You will learn a lot of things because you're experiencing an experience or someone that is very different from you or could be very similar to you but also have like very different ways of expressing it.
I find that to be pretty interesting, too, that very often not only are you asked to walk a mile in someone else's moccasins, like, I can't really relate to what it's like to have a particular experience, but that's the whole point. But in some cases, poetry is designed to make people say, I thought it was just me. You mean somebody else feels that way, too? So poetry has the ability to do both. So just talk about, as we wind up, we've got about 3 minutes left, your hopes for this weekend, starting with you, Anvi.
I hope to enjoy the poetry slam. I've met a lot of the people competing at the preliminary rounds and the semifinal rounds, and just meeting them again would be nice. I haven't performed in front of that many people, poetry in front of that many people, so that'll also be an interesting experience. So I hope that it goes well.
Yeah.
Well, good luck to you and to you, Dima. You're Same. Looking forward to it as well, I'm sure.
Yeah, because this is a really big event. Like, for semis and prelims, I just kind of did my own thing. I didn't really think about the details, but now this is, like, the big thing. You got to give it your all. But then again, it's also about listening to other people's stories and seeing how they give it their all, and it's just about making new friends and stuff. Like, that sounds cheesy, but that's really what it's about. Like, in prelims alone, I realize that there are a lot of people out there.
Well, good luck to you both, Dima Awadalla, Anvi Gulrajani, young poets at Youth Speaks, and to the senior program manager, Janae Johnson. Thank you both for sharing your work, and to Janae for being the mentor for these young talents. That's it for Your Call. You can listen to past shows or sign up for the podcast at yourcallradio.org. Lauren Schechner and Laura Wenis produced today's show. Joshua Wildner is the social media producer. Phil Hartman is chief engineer. Kevin Vance is the studio engineer. Thanks for joining us. I'm Renee Kemp, and this is Your Call.